I am so excited that for 2024, Your Brand Amplified is proudly sponsored by one of my favorite platforms, Simplified. This AI-driven platform is a game changer for design and video content. With Simplified, I can effortlessly transform lengthy videos, such as my podcast, into engaging, shareable clips and streamline workflows with an intuitive subtitle generator. For designers out there, you can explore the AI-powered image generator, create compelling presentations, and design eye-catching YouTube thumbnails with ease. Revolutionize your creative process at simplify.com with a free trial. Now let's dive into today's guest.
Welcome to Your Brand Amplified, the podcast where we interview marketers, publicists, and brands to learn their stories, what makes them tick, and tips and tricks that make a difference.
Right before we pushed record, Drs. Todd and Kim Saxton and I were speaking about when we first connected and found that it was about a year and a half ago. And between their schedules with their amazing book and all of the work they do with startups and as professors and my crazy podcast schedule, we are finally here after a few tries. So thank you both for being here today.
Delighted it worked out. Thanks for having us.
Yeah, nice. We've been looking forward to this for that long.
Oh, I've been looking forward to having both of you on as well. So let's first talk about, you're both professors, you write books, you work together. Did you meet at university? How did this path, you know, evolve into realizing that you're going to have this great partnership in work and in life?
So interestingly, we were on the East Coast, but we went to very different schools. I went to MIT and he went to the University of Virginia. But we both got hired into the same consulting firm about 5 months apart. So we were kind of the more junior members. And we were put on a project together and we just annoyed the crap out of each other. I mean, it was ugly. Like the company owner pulled me aside and said, you got to do something. Like,
yeah. I think it was stop yanking his chain.
Anyway, so we ended up going on a company ski trip to West Virginia and discovered we actually had feelings for each other and started dating. This idea of let's get it out of our system, right? Because this is obviously not a great long-term match.
And we just celebrated our 35th anniversary.
My gosh. Congratulations.
Yeah. So we did, back to your initial question, we did meet professionally, but not at university. We were in consulting for about 6 years and then had our first child on the way and kind of felt like if and when we grow up, spending 2 to 4 days a week on the road with a growing family it's hard. We love the project work. We love the analysis that went into it. But increasingly, we were involved in sales, you know, kind of selling the project and then the end delivery. But the part we liked was the middle, disentangling these really complex problems. Both of our parents have history in university level and other education. We decided to go back and get our PhDs and dig a little deeper into the things that we really like doing in the practice of consulting. So we ended up in the doctoral program at Indiana University together, Kim in marketing, myself in strategy and entrepreneurship. And that was many years ago. And here we are still doing it.
Wow. I'm so inspired by that.
Yeah. And I think it's possible that we have too much time spent together. Some people would feel like not every moment is, you know, fabulous, of course, but you know,
it is for me. I don't know what she's talking about. So,
it turned from doing research together, writing book together. We also do a lot of our training together. So we've done a couple of Ironman triathlons together. Yeah.
Wow. That is not the kind of training I thought you were going to say that you train. And I was like, that's perfect because strategy and entrepreneurship and marketing. So you can go in and hold workshops. But Ironman, that's a whole other level.
Okay. So it wasn't enough that we work all day together. We also work out together.
Hey. It works really well for us and we like how we're able to experience those different elements, but would not suggest that every couple should either have or aspire to have the same number of threads. It wouldn't work for a lot of people that we know who are great and great together. So,
yeah. Let's talk about what that looks like today. So you worked at the same consulting firm, you built that up, you decided that you were actually partners and this hate was actually love. You started to have a family, get your PhDs in different areas, and then become professors. But were you still consulting on the side? Were you still doing some part-time consulting? Did you create your own consultancy at that time?
Yeah. So when we first went back to the doctor program, Todd went and I ran a full-time consulting business with a one-year-old. And then he would come home and he would talk about all these articles he's reading and these theories, and we could see how they applied and we would start to apply them in the work. And we even hired a few doctoral students also to help us. And I decided to go back and get my PhD. I started a year after him. And so how much consulting we do really depends on a lot of different things. Like in 2019, we published this book. So then we were doing, you know, the book thing. There's no time for consulting when you do 20 podcasts and 30 workshops, right? And then the pandemic hit and oh my gosh, we were crazy busy because everybody needed advice. We were doing webinars left and right, writing pieces, you know, just trying to help these businesses stay afloat. And then by 2021, I had launched a new program for the school. So I had like three jobs at the university and that just kept us like so busy. But then this year, we kind of pulled ourselves out of a few university things and we've sort of ratcheted up our consulting business a little bit more. And I guess we're just lucky that people think we have ideas that we can offer. Our favorite kind of work that we're doing right now is customer discovery work for startups. I mean, we teach people how to do customer discovery. It's really hard. And because our early consulting work was interviewing people, like we've each interviewed, you know, thousands of people over the phone. So it turns out that customer discovery is just a different version of that.
It's so fascinating because I was just talking about this for the DMM, the Digital Media Management Program at USC yesterday, and how you create the right kinds of research, right? And we were talking about ethnography and we were talking about qualitative research versus quantitative research. And that is actually what they're having to do for their activity over the next couple of weeks is go out there and observe and look at customers and personas, people that they think could want whatever digital project they've chosen for the classwork. I love talking about this, if you can't tell. I love getting into it. And it is something that a lot of people don't understand. I think a lot of businesses start because they see an issue, which is fantastic. Maybe they're experiencing something or they see a need, but then they don't think about the different use cases, the people who are going to use it typically versus atypically. They don't think about, is this actually going to be something new and valuable out there in the world? So how do you take and synthesize all of this information and help organizations understand that they need to look a little deeper and take a little more time to set themselves up the right way?
And particularly, I think, to your point, technical founders love to go present a solution, right? They are so enthused and passionate about it, and they're short. They never stop to think about how does the customer actually view the problem? And it's one of the Detbergs we talk about in the book, the Titanic effect, that kind of rushing to market with a solution before you have fully understood the customer experience, how they talk about it, how they're solving that problem today. And those are all essential kind of building blocks to getting to that value proposition and some kind of proof of concept, whatever that looks like.
Yeah. So the main thing that we really teach and that really people struggle with is that you can't present your solution and ask people what they think of it. You have to start bigger than that. Well, you have to start with like a generic question that everybody wants to talk about. So like, tell me about this thing. How does it work? And as they're talking, usually they'll tell you, well, I hate this. Or this would be okay if it weren't for that, right? And it's you grab a hold of these things and you just start mapping what are their points of pain? Where are their opportunities to delight them? And then you have to ask yourself, does my product do this, right? Because if you ask people, is this an interesting product? Most of the time, they won't tell you your baby's ugly.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. And then you say, oh, would you sign a letter and intend to buy it? Oh, well, wait, I've got five steps I have to do, blah, blah, blah. Right. But that's because you haven't actually landed on the pain point that there is worth paying for at this instant.
Yeah.
Nobody likes to hear that.
Would you say that's one of the largest sources of failure for new businesses?
So it's the combination of either being focused on a pain point that's not important enough to spend the money to solve, or not being able to really differentiate and add value beyond what they're already doing. You know, behavior is hard to change. And as long as I have an okay solution, I'm not going to do something different. I need revolutionary value added to want to do something. Or if the, like, we're looking at something where there are some services, but honestly, nobody feels like the area is very successful. So they're willing to buy another service with the hopes that it would be successful. Well, okay. But if it isn't after 6 months, right, they're not going to renew, right? So you got to sort through all that to understand what value do people really need to see to be willing to part with X dollars to get.
Yeah.
And not to jump too fast to the Titanic effect, but I think it's kind of a good bridge to that. In that mistake that Kim was talking about and you raised is something that we see a lot of startups make, but it's almost never just one thing that kills a startup, even a very promising one. And that's why we use the metaphor of the Titanic. We can kind of go back to our origin story if you would like. But basically, the Titanic in part sank because it hit an iceberg, but there were so many other issues that got the ship to that point and that exacerbated the problem once it did hit the iceberg that were on, you know, some of it was human and people just being in the wrong place at the wrong time, making bad decisions. Some of it was about the technology of the ship per se. And there were some wonderful new technologies that White Star Line was experimenting with, but they also didn't foresee the hidden consequences of getting in that situation. And some of it was marketing, who they were selling to and how they then had to fulfill the hopes and dreams of the very wealthy as well as the lesser class, the lower class.
Yeah, I usually say it's hard to serve two segments simultaneously, but imagine doing that in one boat.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. And trying to unveil all these new technologies and all these other things that were so revolutionary at the time. So, I mean, I think that Titanic effect is the synthesis of all of the work that you've done and all of the things that you've experienced in working with all these startups and studying, right? So it's the Titanic effect, successfully navigating the uncertainties that sink most startups. Love that. So let's talk about that a little bit. How long did it take to decide, number one, that you said, gosh, we need to write a book about all of the things that we've learned and put it in something where people might not be able to work with us one-on-one or attend a class, can still get this information that we've gathered.
Yeah, exactly. And that in itself, like many startups, was a very iterative process in that over a number of years, at the point we started thinking about it in this way, it was probably 10 to 15 years of seeing our alumni, our students, people that we worked with in the community, companies that we invested in, kind of systematically making similar mistakes. And one way to approach entrepreneurship or any kind of education and to say, like, here's a playbook, here are the things you do. But if you don't caution people about the things that they shouldn't do, those in many cases are the things that will sink them. So that's the slant that we wanted to take. And the initial kind of vision of it, and we were putting together a first presentation for a big venture community event and kind of came up with the notion of an iceberg, right? Because the majority of it is below the surface, but you need to understand what's below the surface. And, you know, my mind like goes right to, even though Kim is the marketing expert, I'm like the come up with names guy. Whether they're good or not is often in question. But I was like, oh, we should call it the Titanic effect because, you know, like icebergs, when we think of icebergs, you think of the Titanic. And Kim, of course, being the sound logic, let's make sure we know what we're talking about, was like, well, let's first, you know, dig into the research a little bit. So she started doing more and more work on the Titanic. I remember we were sitting in different rooms and she was like, you are the luckiest. I'm going to finish. Like, they made all of the mistakes.
Mistake, and here's this mistake. I mean, I'm sure if you looked at any, you know, failure situation through the right lens, you could identify the, those kinds of things. But it really started out as a workshop, a presentation that we did. And then somebody in the audience said, where were you a year ago? Right. And then the next time we did it, someone said, oh my gosh, this needs to be a book. And we looked at each other like, write a book? What? No. So then he got the idea, like, let's do it. So he wrote a one-page overview of the book. And I said, yes, Mr. Visionary, if you get a publisher, then I'll write it. Right. Right. Don't put the work in until you know you have something that you're committed to. And by golly, 28 days later, he had a publisher.
Wow. That's, that is unheard of.
Okay. Daniel, you have to write the first chapter. So like just throwing down, and it's actually a great practice to have for yourself and for others you're working with, is like, don't say, let's write a book. Let's say, okay, what are the two or three steps that we need to take to get started writing a book? Find a publisher, write the first chapter. And if you can do those things, then you kind of move forward. So I did, I wrote the first chapter. We shared it with a couple of seasoned entrepreneurs and investors and got some really helpful feedback.
They weren't afraid to say your baby is ugly.
That's right. No, it was great insight and input. But you mentioned this thread. I want to come back to it because I think it's important that we love the impact we have with our students and the people we work with in the community. But it is hard to scale. And every venture needs to think about, how do you have more impact on more people, whatever that looks like and whatever kind of success looks like. And we thought this was one way to kind of extend our voice to people that we didn't have the opportunity to work with directly and at least share some, you know, some of our learnings from over the years.
Nice. Wow. So can you talk about some of the other hidden things that people don't think about when they are starting their businesses? Because I think we all come in bright-eyed and bushy-tailed, except for the people I've interviewed who are, you know, finance people first and then start a business. They think of a lot of other things that, like, somebody like myself as an entrepreneur doesn't think about. But I think there are more people probably like me who are coming in saying, I have this idea, here's what I want to do, that we're not thinking about, oh yeah, and then we're going to have to do this, and then this, and then this.
Yeah, so one I like to think about from the marketing perspective is kind of what I call like the body count, which is like, all right, so how many people have this problem? How many people could have this problem? And is
to
that
be clear, it's not dead body count.
Right. I should probably call it head count, not body count, right? And so then just even thinking about a funnel. So if this many people had it, you know, what would we have to do to scale marketing so that this many people can hear about it? A classic example, we were talking with somebody who had, in this particular market, there's a device and they were using this device and they had a really good success rate with what they were trying to accomplish, but they didn't like the device. So they wanted to fix it, right? And so we started like doing like, well, let's examine this company that has this device. It turns out that that company had captured only 10% of all procedures in that marketplace with this device. So if you get a new device, you're going to be splitting 10% of the market with somebody, unless you can figure out how to increase the penetration beyond that 10%. And so do you know what is keeping people from using the device? Otherwise, and it just turned out that it was going to be easier to move to an animal market instead of a human market, where there was actually a huge number of procedures that this device could work for.
And no regulatory
and path. No regulatory fast.
So
that's what I'm saying. Like, just the, you know, do the head count. Like, even if this was successful and you got it in, how much money can you make? Is the amount of money you can make worth the work that you're going to have to put in?
So a couple of the other ones, and we've talked about several in the marketing, what we call the marketing ocean. So to extend the metaphor, we have these four oceans that we identify: the marketing, the technical, the strategy, and the human. Mm-hmm. And each of those oceans has its own kind of set of detbergs or icebergs that can hurt you. And it's not unusual for, in the early stages, you know, three people get together for coffee or a beer and are like, hey, we have this great idea, let's do this thing, and we'll split it, call it the curse of thirdsies, without thinking at all about who's actually going to do the work to move this forward and what are the gaps we have on our management team. So we call it inequitable equity, that the inclination, because it seems fair, is to split things evenly out of the gate. And the reality is you just don't know who's going to do the heavy lifting to get work done. So you want to make sure you hold back some equity and that you have that equity vest over time, meaning it's doled out over a 3 or even longer period as you hit milestones and as people make their contribution. It is really hard once you give somebody 50% or 33% to claw back some of it, right? That's a very uncomfortable conversation for partners, for friends, for co-founders. Whereas if you say, hey, we're only 5% of the way in the journey, so we each get, you know, 2% now, and then as we move forward and as we make progress, we can allocate equity in a way that is rewarding the people who are actually, you know, doing the work.
Or the worst one I saw is somebody was bringing on two partners. They were putting up all the money, but they were only going to take 40% of the equity. And I was like, did you realize the other two people could outvote you?
Because each of the other had 30%. So she was like, hey, it's good. I still have more equity than anybody else. Well,
not actually.
Ouch. Yeah. And then people don't think about if they're going to look for funding, outside funding in the future, and they're going to have to be able to offer some equity in a lot of those cases, right?
What if it turns out that you're not that good at running a company and you're tired of it and you want to bring in a professional manager, which happens a lot?
And we also see a lot of the flip side where people feel because of what they read, what their friends tell them, they're not successful entrepreneurs if they don't go out and try and raise venture capital money or whatever. And, you know, they got to raise $1 million to be successful. And there are a lot of great startups that actually shouldn't be looking at raising money, at least at a certain stage, because they can get to the next level. They can make progress through self-funding and through kind of more modest efforts. And the baggage that goes along with raising that seed round or those early rounds in terms of demonstrating returns to those investors, how much growth is involved, et cetera, that's a huge debt in a different way that you're taking on. So we encourage a lot of entrepreneurs we work with, like, step back and think about what your goals are. And if they were to, I want to spend more time with my family, I want to have more control of my life, don't go raising a bunch of money because you're doing exactly the opposite.
I love the fact that you bring up this concept of debtbergs. And so debt isn't just financial. It can be technical. It can be in the right people, as you mentioned. And then what was the fourth ocean category?
Strategy is kind of the interconnections between those. So we see these hidden debts of being unbalanced. Technical founders are often way ahead on the product and technology development before they talk to customers, do that discovery that we were talking about, that Kim was referring to.
Or we've seen the opposite where, you know, they're really good at selling. So they've sold something that nobody can deliver.
Wow.
Or it costs so much to build that they're selling everything at a loss. That's pretty good to understand before you've sold something. Helpful.
I can't tell you how many startups we've dealt with that are selling everything at a loss. And it's like, okay, but did you even do the math to know how much this was going to cost you? Even if it's a service, I mean, every service also has costs associated with it. And then all of a sudden they, you know, do the math. They're like, we would have to price it twice as high to make any money. Okay, that's a problem.
Yeah, guilty. Guilty of that, of overstaffing, because I'm like, oh, I'm getting all these clients. And then going, wait, when I actually did the calculation, I'm like, oh, I need to actually charge this much, not this much for the amount of people. So there's definitely imbalance. So I wish I had read your book before I went through that experience. But I think your book was just out and I hadn't met you yet. So now I can. Does the book come with a workbook as well? Or does it come with exercises people can use?
So what it comes with is, at the back, there's sort of a checklist of the biggest icebergs for you to assess yourself. And you can download that as a tool off of the website. Being at the university, we haven't created like an online work, you know, class or something like that, because, you know, we felt like it would compete with the university, which probably sometime we should. But there are tools you can download from the website. We have like maps, so you can like red flag your little cute little red, yellow, and green icebergs.
So the idea there, and you don't have to buy anything to be able to do this, but, you know, a lot of startups have weekly or regular stand-ups where people talk about, and they're mostly talking about the successes and having a vehicle to say, okay, where are the danger zones? Like, maybe not they're in the red, but at least they're yellow and, you know, we need a caution signal here. And finding a way to kind of capture that and have that be part of the regular discussion, we think is really important for any startup, because you want every level of the organization to be helping think about, but also be willing to share when there are early warning signs, not just early wins.
Yeah. So, I mean, we do not argue that you shouldn't take on debt. I mean, you should take on debt. Mm-hmm. What we're just saying is you should recognize the debt you have and then begin to think about, how do you mitigate that debt? Or, you know, you're not going to de-risk it completely, but how do you reduce the ramifications of having too much debt?
Yeah. There's also something that you guys talk about, which is, how you can scale by looking at alternative business models. I think people traditionally, they'll look at somebody successful and say, okay, that's exactly the roadmap I need to take. But they don't think about other ways that they can achieve the same things. So can you please illuminate us on some of those things that we should be thinking about as entrepreneurs? Because there are a lot of people who are new to the entrepreneurship journey or they're pivoting to something else who listen to the podcast.
Yeah. So we have a great workshop that we do, and it's actually a really fun workshop where there have been articles, and there's maybe like 20 to 30 different business models. And so we ask, you know, people to take the current business model you have and just look over this list. What is an alternative, right? And so, I mean, a classic one is for capital equipment. It always used to be bought. Well, you know, it's hard to spend $100,000. So someone brilliantly came up with, well, why don't you lease it over time, right? And then you get a bigger revenue stream than if you sold it because you're essentially financing it, right? So you have actuarial issues of that. And the same could be said about, you know, anything. Like, so maybe it's a one-time purchase, or maybe it's a subscription, or maybe you think of, we often see this, we software as a service, you know, SaaS companies. Oh, the software does it all. Does it? Or is there also a service revenue model? Mm-hmm. Granted, it doesn't have the same margin, but without that service, maybe the software doesn't work very well.
Uh-huh.
And if you think about, for example, other models that we like to use, music and entertainment, you know, 20, 30 years ago, music was consumed in these big LPs. And it's still consumed that way today by some, right? But there is also a huge market in single-use streaming, very small revenues, but collectively, big companies, and also wonderful ways to organize your own library of music, your own, you know, shows and access them. So thinking about different ways to package and different ways your product or service might be consumed. And that also comes from that deep understanding of the customer experience, the customer journey, the problem that they're trying to solve. And that can give you insight into different ways to create value, but also capture value from whoever you're working with.
Oh my goodness. My thinking along the lines lately has been, I was kind of stunned. I was talking to Comcast and I was not happy about the prices that we had. And so they said to me, literally said to me, well, you've got some set-top boxes. You could return those because now, you know, the TV can just access the streaming app. And I thought to myself, well, what in heaven's name are cable companies even about anymore, right? You think about TV, you just have three TV stations, right? And then cable brought all these other TV stations to us. Now, I mean, everything is an app. So then why would I ever pay for a piece of hardware?
Yeah. Why? Sure. But people still do. So I think that's part of meeting your customer, I guess, or people who maybe aren't ready to take that next step in a product. What are some other pitfalls that you see? One thing I was thinking of is, I'm sure you see a lot of times when you work with an organization and they're a startup and they have this idea, but then by going through this line of inquiry, they realize that they actually want to do something completely different, or they want to serve a completely different audience. So do you see that as a common issue or problem?
Yeah. So one of the things we think is really important for young companies, whether they're going to be, you know, funded startups or just, you know, smaller organizations, is really to experiment. I mean, you don't know out of the gate, even after you did all the best customer discovery in the world, you know, whenever this thing gets in people's hands, people do different things than you expected. So you have to plan that you are going to pivot, right? That you're not going to assume you didn't get it right. This first one is a hypothesis. And so it's going to need to change. And so it's hard sometimes for people to change. And so it just feels really like, oh, I did something wrong. When it's like, no, this is the natural evolution, right? We don't want to penalize you because you pivoted, because you're probably going to have to. But we see the opposite thing happen too, what we call pinballing. So you talk to one customer, you go over here, and then you talk to the next customer, you go over there, and then you talk to the next customer, you go over there. And it's like, you don't even know what you are. Nobody knows what you are. So being able to identify when is the right time to change and what to change to versus constantly changing so that you get lost is a real fine line.
And even when you are pivoting, doing it strategically with intent and as an experiment, as opposed to just, you know, randomly changing direction. In fact, a big motivation for us in this work was some of the unintended consequences of kind of the lean startup approach, which we are big fans of. Like, get out of the university, get out of the lab, get out of your basement, get out of the garage, interact with the customers early, experiment. Big fans of that. But what we started to see, as Kim was suggesting, were these pinball entrepreneurs who were just, every week they were changing. You'd talk to, in the same venture club, we saw a company under the same name pitch what was going to be a fuel additive. And then 6 months later, they were pitching what was a food supplement.
Wait a minute.
And you kind of scratch your head going, huh, is that even safe? You know. So anyway, the lean startup has a lot of good things about it, but seeing people take on these hidden debts by constantly changing their, you know, what you stand for, right? Your brand, which is so important. And when you build a brand and build an identity that goes along with that, it's hard to pivot and have that stick in the minds of your customers or potential customers. So as Kim said, you have to make some of those decisions that are hard and take on those kind of debts, but at least be informed about what the trade-offs are and what that hidden debt on your ledger kind of looks like so that you can combat that and keep it from hurting your venture in the future.
Now, he just led into one of my biggest rants, and which I could bring up and probably is aligned with some of your thinking, or you haven't had a chance to talk much. And so I want to make sure you get a chance to talk, or you can let me talk, do my rant if you
no,
want.
No, please. I want to hear this. I want to hear your rant.
And maybe this is because I'm a traditional marketer and marketing professor, but I see a lot of, especially tech startups, they go to market and all their marketing is around lead generation, demand generation, and they've got 1,000 tactics, but no branding. And half the time people are like, I don't even know what you're offering because there's so much jargon. But when I see really successful tech startups, they started with a brand and they had a strategy about how to build that brand. I mean, one in our local community, their color was orange. And I would have said, good Lord, nobody can ever own orange, but they own orange like you wouldn't believe it, to the tune of a $2.5 billion exit, right? So that's really owning orange. They are masters of brand building. And you can't wait until this thing is 4 years old to decide what your brand is going to be about. You have to be working on that at some level from the beginning.
You are so preaching to the choir right now. It drives me crazy when I was more focused on the PR side of comms and marketing, and people would come say, I'm ready for PR. I'm like, what do you mean? What's your product? What are you offering? What's your messaging? Do you have, do you know who you are at the core? Do you have your purpose, your vision, your mission, your positioning statement? Do you know who your customers are? Or do you just have a logo and a website and you think you know where you're positioning yourself, but you haven't done that testing? Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Anyway, I think there's an important role for demand generation and lead nurturing, and there are really important strategies and tactics there and, revenue operations. But it's got to start under the umbrella of, something that's knowable. I mean, I always liken this. I had to do something where I walked around and knocked on the doors in my neighborhood, and this organization had done zero marketing. It was 100% sales. And so every single time I talked to somebody, it was 15 minutes. I got like an 80% conversion rate, but after 15 minutes, and all I could think is if someone would have done some marketing, this could be 5 minutes.
Yeah.
I have to bring up the other one, not to let Kim rant even further, but the, oh, you don't need a website. All you need to do is, have a Facebook page.
Oh, gee.
Yeah, social media can help. But again, it has to be part of a strategy and a plan. And you still need a central point to direct people to collect information if that's part of it. So,
well, and if Facebook went away tomorrow, you don't own Facebook. You're giving away all of your IP. You don't have access to any of the customers unless they did purchase and you're able to do it in Shopify or whatever else. But yeah.
So the other one I hear is, isn't it better to have a Facebook page than a bad website? No, there's no excuse for a bad website. Like, they're canned packages for $200 a year. I'll at least float something that isn't awful.
Knowing that so many businesses are going to fail within the first, we don't even have to say 5 years, first year, 2 years. Do you ever have to have those hard conversations with people where you say you actually don't have a product that is viable?
Well, I might have sometimes been called Nancy Naysayer or Debbie Downer. I have to pull that punch a little bit more often than I used to.
Well, and some of the training that we've done, there's a national program called ICOR that's sponsored by the NIH to help universities get better and get better at commercializing their property. And a lot of it, as a coach, is to help people come to their own conclusion. So you're not saying your baby's ugly. You're saying, look at all these pictures of beautiful babies. Now look at your baby. What do you think?
Yeah.
And obviously, that metaphor can only extend so far. But it is important to not just say, this will never work, but to help them recognize where there are gaps and how they might be able to overcome those. Because there are lots of reasons why a company and a product might fail. It's the thesis of our book. But there should be an equal number of ways to kind of navigate around that, to reposition the product, have different functions, and or target a very different audience. I'll give you something very tactical that we really like to use in our entrepreneurship classes, but also in with early stage entrepreneurs, is to just envision this matrix of different functionality on one side. So product one, product two, product three, and different market segments on the other axis. So it's just forcing that process of saying, and at some stages, this is a bad thing, but early on, kind of that we could also, right? We could also build this instead. We could also serve this other market segment that may not be the biggest segment, but maybe they have the biggest pain points. So they're going to be the easiest to get to. And if you are systematic about kind of mapping that, that then makes the choice of your launch segment, what we call your beachhead, as coming from logic and having thought through the alternatives, as opposed to where a lot of entrepreneurs start is, no, I've got a solution for X market. And they don't even think about the alternatives.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. So much to think about. Now, if somebody's not in Bloomington, Indiana, and can't take courses from you at the university, how can they work with you? Are there, your workshops open to others? I know that you travel a lot and speak as well. And is that all of that available on your website along with links to the book?
Yeah, it hasn't been updated lately because, you know, of the 2020 and then what we've gotten back to. So we could do that. But I'll tell you what, amazing to us, people just email us through the website. And I mean, one Saturday we're both working and we get this email for somebody like, I'm using your book to run my business. And I wondered if we could have lunch so we could talk about the next step. Yes, we do two coffees is what we call it. And that could be two Zooms, right?
Like, wow.
We'll listen and share, and I mean, the university and the state pay us, so that's our contribution to making the world a better place. And yeah, we see how it goes.
Yeah. Wow. Well, that's really amazing, and that's so generous of you. And I'm imagining that you probably get a lot of those asks. So how do you balance your time? Because you also like to have some time outside of the world of marketing and entrepreneurship and strategy, but you do it for your work at university, with the workshops and other things that you do, with writing your book. I imagine that you have other book ideas and offshoots that you're thinking of already that you're probably going to put out, but you also want to have time for that balance in your family and Ironman, you know, triathletes and like all of that stuff.
Well, so I mentioned earlier, just throwing up a relatively small barrier, even something as simple as saying, doing a lot of traveling over the next week, can you get back to me at the end of the month and we'll set up a time? It's amazing how many people just don't follow up on something like that. Or, you know, your idea is interesting. Can you find five other companies doing something similar? That'll give us something to talk about. People don't follow up. So that gives you a good sense of like, who's going to be coachable? Who's going to actually do some of the hard work of moving the idea forward? So we do find that just putting up small barriers, we're not trying to make it hard. As Kim said, we're not asking you to pay us. We're just like saying, we just want you to walk around the block and come back and then, you know, email us again. And 50% or more of people will like say, I don't want to get up and walk around the block. Not for you.
My favorite is, can you send me a paragraph by email that I can forward to a customer to help? You know.
Wow.
I get that paragraph less than half the time. So I've been writing notes and I've got it And if you ever do, like, it's in one of my notes on my phone, but, you know, then they don't. So I'm like, you know, after a year, I just let that note go, you know?
Yeah. I do that sometimes with my students as they're thinking about their capstones. And I'm thinking about, who do I know who I can introduce them to? Because I've, you know, worked in a lot of different fields.
Sure.
And I'll say, okay, go to my LinkedIn, find five people in the industry that you're interested in, look them up, let me know what you come back with, and then I'll make an introduction. So, I mean, they are my current students, so they typically do follow through. But I'm amazed that so many people would come and ask you for your advice, but then they wouldn't take advantage of this offer that you're giving them.
Are all amazed. We like 2 weeks later, we're like, how hard was that paragraph to write? I do the thing with my students who want a recommendation for, you know, graduate school. I'm like, you write the letter first.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a good skill to have.
Right.
I'll tell you, 90% of them write that letter. They're pretty good. They ask.
Well, they know that that is gold for that recommendation.
Yep. Yeah, they're smart on that one.
Well, I've really enjoyed finally having this conversation with you. I'm really excited to dig into your materials. Because even though I'm in this world, I always learn new things and new approaches to take and ways to think about things. So thank you so much, Drs. Kim and Todd Saxton, for being here. We will link your book in the show notes and my website, newsletter. Is there any other resource that you'd like people to review? Do you want them to also go to your website?
They're welcome to. I mean, the book's commonly available wherever you like to buy books. It's available as an audiobook and also an ebook and a paperback, you know, whatever is your fancy. And yeah, if people, you know, listen to it, read it, whatever, and just want to let us know, we're always happy to hear from them. And so they can always reach out to us, you know, mksaxton@iu.edu and tsaxton@iu.edu.
And caution in advance, if you find our voices grating, don't do the audiobook, because we did choose to do it ourselves.
Great.
For the most part, which was in and of itself an interesting undertaking, navigating a lot of uncertainty. But yeah, we chose to do the audiobook ourselves. So they're just laying it out there.
Yep.
Love that.
Even though these professionals, the first version had a lot of technical data, and we were the ones who said, look, kill it, and we have to redo it. And that was so
we re-recorded the whole book.
Wow. That could be a whole other episode.
Just writing
about that and the intricacies of publishing and books. I always like to ask if you have a favorite quote, mantra, family motto, or it's a wisdom that you live by.
Well, so I have one I do frequently use, because I think it is very difficult for anyone to stay strong when things feel difficult. And so for me, when I was learning how to bike, it was headwinds were the difficult thing. And so as we were going into, you know, 20 mile an hour headwinds, I would just on my bike say, head down while I'm pedaling on my aero bars, the wind is my friend, the wind is my friend, the wind is my friend. And now anytime I find myself in different kinds of headwinds, I find myself just calming myself by repeating that again. The wind is my friend, the wind is my friend. Because the hard things are what really make you better.
I want to come back, and not to get, you know, too much of a downer here, but I do, the COVID and the last few years have been really hard on a lot of people. And even before, there were a lot of people who wanted to start a company, wanted to write a book, wanted to, and just taking that first step is so hard. But those things that have been on your bucket list, your wish list, you know, that when you find yourself repeating, someday I want to take the first step. And that might be reaching out to us to ask, what was your first step? You know, just reach out to somebody, get help. And I think COVID led to a little bit of mentality for a lot of people, or cultural kind of shut-in mentality. You know, I can do everything from my bed, my desk, wherever your computer and Zoom happens to be. And we have to break out of that individually and societally. So I think that's really important. Find a way to take that first step and you'll go from there.
First step is the hardest, but if you don't take it, you don't know where you're going to end up.
Exactly. Wow. And it's part of the journey is the fun, right?
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for giving us so many insights into what businesses need to consider when they're starting up, some of the pitfalls, making sure that they're really serving the needs of a community or an audience and not just putting one more thing out into the world. Just really appreciate your time today. I'm so glad we finally got to have this conversation. I look forward to continuing to stay in touch and learn from you. And thank you to the audience for watching or listening to this episode of Your Brand Amplified. I will be back again in a few days with some more amazing stories from experts who will help make your business and hopefully personal lives a little bit sweeter. Want more? Check out amplifywithannika.com or follow me on socials at amplifywithannika. As we close out today's episode, I want to thank Simplified again for making it possible. For all marketers and creators out there, Simplified is your ally in effortlessly crafting on-brand content with design and video AI. Discover how AI can enhance your creative process at simplify.com. Start for free and elevate your content game. Thanks for listening, and here's to your next creative breakthrough.